On behalf of Archer and Carasoft, we would like to welcome you to today's podcast, focusing on how a successful resiliency program aligns your impact analysis, continuity planning, IT disaster, recovery planning, crisis management, and incident response activities with your organization's broader business strategy.
So thanks for being here today. I'm Chad Mitchell. I'm a systems engineering manager at Cisco. I used to be an engineer helping out all of US public sector as a deployment guy, sales guy, everything. I've done the full gamut of things, but we're here to talk about resiliency, something that sometimes might make us drink beers or cocktails. Applications staying online, networks staying up, connectivity being there. So building processes and technology that naturally adapt to adverse conditions, making corrections, avoiding organizational outages, and then, how we're going to look at and assess our operational risk. So I'm going to go ahead and let these guys introduce themselves. Mike, go ahead.
I'm Mike Watson. I'm the Chief Information Security Officer for the Commonwealth of Virginia. I've been there for what feels like forever at this point, since about 2007. Our organization does all the IT for the state. We're very much like Nancy, who was up here earlier, talking from Texas. We perform for 60 plus agencies and about 100,000 users, and lots of data, a couple thousand endpoints and such like that. So,
Kevin?
Yeah, thanks. I'm Kevin Stein from NIST. I'm our chief cybersecurity advisor, and I also lead our applied cybersecurity division. I think from a NIST perspective, we really try to focus on building trust, and we try to do that through advances in standards and technology and measurement science. And I think when we unpack trust, those concepts of risk management and resilience are very core to that. So certainly resilience is a key part of what we do and think about.
Thanks. And Mark?
For this audience, I'm Michelle's boss, and we were in Hawaii last week, so I did learn with her about tiki bars last week when we were in Hawaii. More importantly, I am the DoD Deputy CISO. I have a longer title than that, but effectively the DoD Deputy CISO. I've been in that job a couple of years, and prior to that, I was the Deputy CIO at NSA. So I'm on detail from the National Security Agency. I've been doing cybersecurity/information assurance since the I Love You hit 20-some years ago. So been doing this a while, both from the acquisition standpoint and from now the policy and oversight standpoint here at the Pentagon.
Thank you all. All right, so we're going to start off with, what are some of the actions that you should keep in mind when weighing your risk and your availability regarding your organization's operations? I'll start off with Mark, actually.
So from a macro level, those of you here from the two past conversations, both with Suda and Michelle, you can probably tell we all work together, but knowing what's on your network, when something happens and is going south on your network, and I'll take Log4j or any of the recent, if you know what's on your network, you can determine how to react to that. And fortunately in DoD, with the standup of Cyber Command 13 years ago now, and then the subsequent hierarchy of the operational chain of command with inside DoD, we do have an operational construct that allows us to go ask those questions and go pull the answers, get the commanders who are locally on the scene, whether they're at the service level tier down to local commands, to actually go address and answer those questions, so we can make risk determinations across the department, whether we shut something down or reroute something or go use a different system than what we were intending to go do a mission with. So we do have a lot of operational flexibility across the department, as long as you know what's on that network and or in those operational scenarios where you can make risk determinations to keep something online or go a different path or use a different tool.
Yeah, Mike, you want to add some more?
Yeah, so I think, when we're looking at, I think it's always obviously the great starting point, right? You got to understand what's there before you figure out how you're going to, protect it resiliency-wise or other. I think when we're looking at, especially in the state, when we're looking at actually understanding and getting to know what's there, one of, I think, the key parts is making sure that your users understand just how important it is to their organization. I can't tell you how many times we've walked into a scenario where someone says, oh, yeah, I don't need that for, it can be down for a month. It won't be a problem, right? Yeah, I have zero systems that can be down for a month without somebody calling me to yell at it, even if they tell me that I don't even need it. So it's been, that conversation to keep in mind when you're talking to folks is probably one of the paramount. And that always is the underlying part with IT, right? And cyber is we're connecting that business to the technology and that business to, what their needs are. And I think that's really in the resiliency area specifically, that understanding of just how important it is to, someone is a tough conversation to have. Fortunately, we've got wonderful folks like NIST that help guide that conversation. You know, and I know we constantly leverage their products to help make sure that we're framing that in the right context.
I think you made a key point as well. I mean, look, resilience is a business or an institutional requirement. I mean, it's something that you can achieve through technology, but ultimately it's the business or the institution that has to make that determination on kind of the degree of resilience and where you apply that, so to speak. And I think some of that just comes down to a lot of the basics of understanding the value of your assets and how you prioritize those assets, kind of broadly speaking. Understanding the dependencies that you have, both from a systems perspective, but also from a supplier perspective, both upstream and downstream. And I think we've all experienced some challenges or made some realizations over the last several years, and certainly very recently, around kind of the resilience of our supply chains, broadly speaking. And again, I think it also comes down to kind of those institutional needs or requirements to make those more risk-informed determinations on how you would achieve these resilience objectives.
Yeah, I've always talked about risk profile and risk tolerance, right? So what is your risk profile? What's your risk tolerance? And taking both of those into consideration kind of helps you define what your policy is going to be against. And then obviously knowing what you have, right? You can't apply the same risk profile to every asset that you have on the network, right? All right, so we all know that resilience or availability is paramount with delivering for employees and customers. And even in some cases, I know DoD mission critical, you know, operations and so forth. So how can we leverage technology to ensure resilience without being too loose with security? Mike, I'll start with you.
Without being too loose with security. Yeah, that's always the key question for us people in the security seat, right? Is trying to figure out how do we balance that business request and business operation with whatever the security requirements are for the system that you have, and hopefully done without getting raked over the coals for it too. You know, I think one of the nice things is that, you know, we have built that concept of availability into our security analysis whenever we're looking at something, right? It is a core tenet of the triad, right? The confidentiality, integrity, and availability. I think the part that we struggle with or that we deal with on the business side is trying to say, okay, that availability piece has to have those hooks and tie-ins to the other components at the same time, right? So an example being, you know, availability and encryption sometimes are at odds depending on what's going on, right? You want to be able to get systems up and running quickly. Encryption components for confidentiality cause some challenges with getting it up and running, maybe at the speed you need, or you know, in some other fashion. So I think that we're constantly trying to figure out how to balance that. And I think it does, again, go back to the business, right? We have some hard decisions to end up making some of these times to say, just how much risk is it? Is this really going to end up causing me a large problem? I could understand some situations at DoD that go both ways, right? You end up with a scenario where, you know, this data cannot get out no matter what. And I can also understand where you end up with an availability scenario. It must, you know, be available no matter what. I think we've run into that in any organization.
Yeah, Mark, I think we talked about data versus time, right?
So just to pull that thread a little bit more, you just can't, for a cyber risk, you just can't have the cyber person making this decision. We have the risk management framework we employ in DoD, and the authorization officials do a rigorous process to make sure all the controls are met, or if they're not met, they're POAMed. But at the end of the day, the system that they're POAMing may or may not need to operate based on some other mission requirement that's outside, completely outside the cybersecurity area of concern. So that decision has to be made holistically. So we're taking a lot of steps within DoD to actually make sure the operational commander gets to weigh in on cyber risk. Now, it may come to a head where eventually, like, it goes up to cyber command. Okay, then General Nakasone's staff can help weigh in on both sides and have that combatant command decision. But you have to take into account the mission risk above and beyond just whatever the cybersecurity risk is. One may outweigh the other, and we're starting to use more examples inside DoD where we are, the cyber risk is that important. We are going to shut it down, and may you have to go find another way to do your mission. So we are doing some of those presses as well across the department. We do have a department scorecard where we track certain levels of compliance for IAVAs and CVEs and other operational concerns we have. So we are keeping each of the 45 commanders and areas of operation accountable for getting these things done, but making sure you have the balance, the operational versus cyber risk is always under consideration.
Kevin, you have anything to add?
Yeah, I think when you're thinking about the focus of tech to help ensure resilience, I mean, quite honestly, I think you gotta plan for it. You gotta consider resilience, your resilience objectives for a system, for an organization, for the institution as a whole. and plan for that. And I think some of the tools that we talk about, and quite honestly, we're in the midst of early stages of an update to our cybersecurity framework now. Maybe some of you have heard of that or are users of that. And we opened that process with a public request for information. We actually got a lot of input from the community on, look, you talk about resilience a little bit in current versions, but there's more you can do to kind of inform and infuse resilience logic into kind of the cybersecurity framework in that context. So that's something that we're definitely taking to heart. I think the other piece, though, when I think about it is, and we're the benefit, certainly in the federal government, of many strategies, some federal-wide, some agency-wide, for example. I'm sure many other organizations kind of fall in that same boat. So when we think about, or when I think about, building for resilience, it's also looking at it in the context of, your plans for cloud transformation or migration there. How are you infusing kind of resilience into those activities? Your personnel and your staffing management, your resilience requirements and abilities will inform, personnel related decisions kind of on that people side. And then just your general management considerations as well. So again, ultimately it comes, in my mind, all roads lead back to, again, understanding from an institution perspective or potentially from a business unit or a system perspective, what are those resilience requirements that you have? And then there are many different paths you can take to help implement those.
Yeah, and I that the one comment there, making sure that there's a tie-in between your people in person and your non-tech related processes. I'll say this is the number one mistake I see made on the security side, whatever the scenario is, everything from incident response to actually recovery services and things, is you forget that like you can only run your people so hard for so long before you run into a large problem. And that resiliency component is key. I mean, even our suppliers, we have suppliers that want to lend in and lean in and help all the time, but they only have so many resources to be able to lend as well. And when it really gets to that emergency scenario, we want all hands on deck, but there's only so much that can be done.
Yeah, one of the things that comes up for me is time to remediate or time to recover, right? And I think the cloud and automation has kind of tied in or helped us out significantly with that in the past few years. And you talked about data versus time, right? If we can shut down that system that is compromised or potentially, causing the problem, if the data is that important, we shut that down and we have the ability to recover very quickly in an alternate path. I think that's some of the things that we've gotten the benefit of through cloud and a lot of the things that we have through automation. All right, so I dealt with this a lot when I was a services delivery guy, going in and doing high level designs and low level designs of how to deploy a solution for a customer. And how do we avoid the rabbit hole of being hyper focused on security or resilience, like the five nines of uptime, and focus on that 0.001%? That can make a project or a deployment overly complex and then end up causing problems or causing availability issues down the road. Kevin, I'll start with you.
In some ways, I'll give the same answer I did before. I mean, you got to plan for it.
Yeah.
Quite honestly, I think starting with the mission needs or the business needs, understanding the value of your assets, prioritizing those in the context of kind of the different business processes, the stakeholder needs as well. And then really, infusing all those and making that that assessment of risk to understand the impact, should there be downtime or whatever the adverse conditions would lead to. And some of our resources are trying to draw a greater spotlight on some of those considerations. Again, like I mentioned before, I mean, we do have guidelines, things like the cybersecurity framework that do infuse some of that logic, whether you're identifying your business priorities and your mission needs or conducting that assessment of risk and understanding what are the protective capabilities that you put in place to help address those risks that you've identified, but then leading then kind of down that life cycle, if you will, into, when bad things do happen, what are your recovery capabilities or how can you continue to deliver those services potentially in a reduced capacity or whatever the case may be. So certainly the guidelines that we produce and some of those resources are intended to help organizations along that journey and help to kind of consider the right things when you're doing your planning and preparations.
So, Mike? So I one of the things, and I don't mean to be too blasphemous here, is I hate SLAs in the context of resiliency, right? Because I'll tell you, the number of people that care that we have an SLA that has, been busted for whatever reason is zero. They, you know, reasonably what they really want is the system to be up and, you know, working. And when, what that has taught me to do over time is that when I'm communicating with my suppliers, really all that SLAs are, whoever it is that I'm making the business agreement is communication of what my expectation of your level of resiliency is supposed to be. I will tell you though, that I think in general, and I'm gonna look to my gentleman to the right here, both of them actually, to help figure out how to fix this. But in general, I think that our community doesn't necessarily do a good job of tying together what, you know, 5 9s, 6 9s, 15 9s really means, right? Because when we have two different architects look at a solution, someone says, well, this is only gonna get me 5 9s, and the other person's gonna say it's gonna get me 7 9s. And when you get really down to it, at some point, it just doesn't matter anymore. Whether it's going to be up enough is what we're trying to figure out how to do. And there's no real consensus to make agreements as to what that looks like. And that tends to lead to disappointment in a lot of circumstances, right? So if your data center has one set of nines and your application has a different set of nines, you know, the application being more than what's in the data center, what happens then, right? Where do you end up taking your SLA counts and stuff from? So what we really need to focus on is figuring out a better way to describe resiliency and describe what it is that we're looking for from our supplier communities, especially as we get closer and closer integration between all the different components that are out there. I get that it's a good business tool. I just don't think it does a really great job from our security perspective and our availability and our resiliency communication. We need to come up with a better way to talk it through. We've attempted a bunch of different things to date. I don't know that I found anything that's a really great silver bullet there. But you know, if anybody has any ideas.
So again, going back to how can you perform something if it doesn't work, right? Kevin touched on it. Back in my naval career, we did a lot of drills and engineering drills. We took something down, see how the ship respond. Doing the same thing here for mission assurance plans and COOP plans. If you're running multiple site operations, you take one of them down, go practice it, or at least go do a tabletop. I know it's a lot of hard. If you start doing an exercise, that counts into the 5 9s, right? Yeah. So you don't want to do an exercise to take it down, potentially bust the SL. But do a tabletop exercise. See if you think it's going to operate like you go do, and we can relocate people if we need to, or they actually have the phone lines available. Run those drills and run those scenarios for continuously operate. If it's that important, if you can live without it, then you'll be able to practice live without it too, right? If we can do without email, pick up the telephone, we can probably live without email for a day. I would love to go do that and go pick it up and pick it up later. But there are things we can go do. And we just, if it's that important to count on, then it probably ought to be assured that those 5 9s, you ought to do it, but that can't be everything.
Yeah, and also the one thing I always thought about was taking into consideration what the amount of time of that 0.001 is, right? If that's 10 minutes over the span of an entire year, that's minimal, right? So back to kind of what we talked about with, you know, being too loose, quote unquote, with security. We talked a little bit about automation. How are you guys within, you know, state, DOD, NIST looking to use automation to increase your resiliency?
So I'll take the cue for, I think the first panel where the question was asked about continuous authorization across DOD. DOD would love to get that right. How many have to go do the 3-year authorization cycle and go back and do the paperwork again? If you had the right instrumentation and the right people monitoring a system, there's no need to go revisit that because you're going to know the continuous health completely. So looking at instrumenting the right systems and the right touch points to be able to give the cyber operators, hey, that's operating in green or there's area of concern. That's what we're trying to get to across DOD. I mean, we've talked about zero trust. That's part of the zero trust model as well. If you have an operator looking at it, and Suda and her panel mentioned the operational critical infrastructure group, making sure that's part of your monitoring plan, because if you can monitor the data centers all you want, but if the AC is not working, they're not going to work anyway. So you have to make sure that's monitored. And in DOD, we also have these things called program of records or DOD weapon systems or wherever your mission systems, whatever you want to call it, making sure they're part of a cybersecurity service provider, monitoring those as well. So they have to be continuously instrumented. And then what data do you need to go do? Because you don't need to know every indication of everything going on, but there are some key indicators and what those are, depending on wherever that system is, that can tell you something's going wrong or not. And then you sort of brought up machine learning, right? Making sure the models are tuned correctly so you can go have a machine tell you if it's operating or not, as opposed to a human with his eye and looking at a graph, right? Because there's too much for us to go with the eyeball to tell something's up. So there's a lot of things we would like to go do in DoD, and with certain systems we are getting there. It's going to take a while, but the whole thought is there to go do continuous ATO, which means the continuous monitoring, utilizing data to go do it. So all those things are on our roadmaps to go get, and we are making progress toward those.
Kevin?
Yeah, so my role at NIST is not an operational one. So, unlike these gentlemen, I'm not kind of in the trenches every single day. But I think the standards and guidelines that we produce have to be informed by operational realities. It's not just the ivory tower, so to speak, but it's the operational realities and how do we produce better resources to help the folks that are in the trenches, so to speak, perform in the way that's most appropriate for their organization. So when I think about every standard or guideline that we're producing, we have to consider what can be automated. There's certainly a point where machines are much better at certain things than humans. They can take some of those mundane tasks, if you will, kind of off the human responsibility or to-do list. So what can be automated? What's feasible to automate today based on the state of technology? How can we produce, kind of infuse that into the resources we provide? How can we produce, example implementations working with industry, take advantage of the cool tools and technologies that exist today that probably many of your organizations are already using, and use those in a way that can automate some of the operational responsibilities that you have to then allow the humans to do human things in some of that higher level kind of analysis and response activities. I'd say maybe the last thread, which probably doesn't have a direct operational tie, but just looking at it from the way we deliver our standards and guidelines, it's not just going to, we do a lot of PDFs. Y'all know that. I know that. But the reality is, can we produce those? And I think we're doing this now more and more, issue those in machine readable formats and ways so that the tools that you are using can ingest those in a much easier way to get those into the hands of the practitioners in a format that will be useful to you.
So I think, I'll try to bridge these two a little bit together because I agree. I think the concept of automation and in the operational sense is just this wonderful thing, right? We're always struggling with staffing. We're struggling with dealing with monotony and details of things that we know somebody could do it better, because if nothing else, I'm going to fall asleep staring at my computer at some point, looking over things. Vulnerability management is probably the number one example that I use all the time for automation, right? Easy thing. We all know what to do to patch our vulnerabilities. We all know that we get this list from pick your security supplier of, vulnerabilities that need to be addressed. And we all know we have to take those and distribute it out to whoever the system owners are, in whatever time frame it is that we've decided or that we queue from NIST or DoD standards, right? We know what needs to be done. The automation is a really wonderful way for us to sort of amp up some of our compliance components and integrate where we know people just can't continue to focus over long terms, right? So I say I'm very at least optimistic about where we're headed with some of these things as time goes on. I will say that, in general, I think that that concept of how to apply that automation in a meaningful fashion is still probably a little bit tough for a lot of folks to get at currently. We're doing a lot to rely on our suppliers to build in interfaces and integrations and things that just aren't there quite yet. We're still in the, well, at least I'll speak for my team only, I won't put anything, but like we're still in the like extract a spreadsheet version of it, run some automation, and then try to figure out how to report out, right? We have a long way to go to get all of our tools to integrate and work in a way where it's able to use, what NIST may publish at some point in the future about, some of those interoperability or pieces that allow automation to run a little bit more effectively. But it's there and it's coming, and I think it's super exciting, especially for us in the cyber world.
Yeah, and I'll comment from the vendor perspective. We also probably still need time to get all of the tool sets there to be able to do the tasks that you want to ask our tools to do, right? Mm-hmm. We're going to go ahead and open it up from here for questions. I know we probably got plenty of time for five questions or so. I'm hard of hearing, so if you guys hear the question and want to repeat it, I might not hear it. So go ahead and shoot. All the way in the back, I could see your hand.
Hi,
So
I can't hear him.
I can repeat it. Yeah. So I got you. Yeah. So the question was about breach attack simulation tools and whether we're using them in effective in the environment. Did I catch it all?
Yeah.
Okay. Yep. I can. Okay. So we use it is not automated. I wish it was. Oh, we're getting closer, but we're not quite there. We do a lot of attack simulation as one of our primary detection methods, right? As much as we try vulnerability assessments and things like that, we tend to find that the breach attack simulations have a larger impact because it's easier to say, I know that we've got these 16 different Microsoft vulnerabilities, but it just feels like a lot. This narrows it in to say, you need to patch these, you know, 8 things or modify the code, you know, to address these particular things to prevent us from being able to get into the system. And we simulate it once a quarter. We go through every quarter and say, you know, anything that's at least externally facing, we go and say, all right, let me test and see what we can get into. And it works reasonably well. I will say that there are better, you know, some places respond better than others. I don't think that's any surprise to anyone. But I will also say that every scenario that we've had some type of security incident, ultimately we've known about it because of that particular, you know, simulation. It doesn't mean that it got corrected completely or whatever, but we at least knew it was there, which made it so we were able to mitigate a lot better than we would have otherwise.
So from a DOD does make extensive use of red teams. Red teams use those tools. With red teams, there's some different flavors. One, there's the red teams that operate on regular cycles, go out and do inspections, go out and test the business networks. We have those of you aware of DOD has the development tests in DOT&E, they go out and text program of records and such. They make you, as they can adapt, they make use of those tools as well. Depending on the construct, whether you're coming from inside or outside, there's varying flavors of effectiveness of those tools. So you just have to watch what you're doing, what kind of results you want to get out of it, depending on which tool set you try.
From our perspective, we do produce a lot of example implementations. So working with industry to try to define a cybersecurity challenge that affects, you know, businesses or agencies in this context, produce example implementations using real products and technologies, actually integrating them to prove out an example solution, you know, down to the, I set this configuration, flip this switch, whatever the case may be, to help address the cybersecurity concerns or challenges in the context of that particular build. We do use, attack simulation tools as we're building those to make sure that the types of capabilities we're building and putting in place actually are responsive to those types of attacks that can be simulated. So that is certainly a part of our process. And then what we learn goes back and informs the development of, you know, or updates to our guidelines.
Thank you for listening to our Public Sector Day at RSA Conference podcast. If you would like more information on how we can assist your organization with cybersecurity needs, please visit www.carasoft.com/cybersecurity or email us at rsa@carasoft.com. Thanks for listening.